Y'all, we live in difficult times. There's war, political unrest, the pandemic, poverty, families being torn, communities ripped by gun violence and people dying every day, police, injustice, it's all bringing so much pain. But y'all, we can look inside our minds and we can understand who we are, become better, and do this thing like we've never done it before. But it all starts with our mental health, and I know we can do it. I believe in you because I believe in me, and I believe in us. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Therapy is Life, where thinking, feeling, and experiencing well-being is what we do. Today, we're going to be talking about autism. I have with me my guest today, Dr. Hummer. How you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you, Gerald. I'm doing well. Thanks.
That's good. That's good. I'm glad to have you on the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
You glad to be here?
Yes.
So, Dr. Hummer, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
So, well, I actually am second oldest of six kids in my family. So there are six of us. And I started venturing out after I went to Bowling Green University, where I went to school, did my undergraduate there, graduated, got my master's degree at Ursuline College, and then went on to get a PhD at Argosy University. And just really, I would have to say that it's what sparked my interest in pursuing autism and studying autism. And what is entailed with autism was our son, who is the baby in our family. And as we continue on, we'll learn a little bit more about that. But that's how I got involved and became interested in autism and what's going on with that. So,
Gotcha. Thank you for sharing that. When we think about autism, it might strike us in many ways. We think about it in a spectrum. That means everyone with autism is not the same. I can think of famous people like Daryl Hannah, Bill Gates, Elon Musk. Yeah, some of the brightest people in the world, right? We might even say Sir Isaac Newton. I can think of a young black man by the name of, I believe, John Howard, who's a martial arts expert, who was diagnosed with it at 33 years old. A lot of these people are high functioning, and they work and do all kind of things. So the first thing I want to say to you about autism, it is something that people can experience in all walks of life. They can have many gifts, talents, and abilities. But before we get too far off into this discussion, because I know y'all might be listening, right? Dr. Hummer, can you help me kind of get a working definition about what autism might be?
Well, kind of paraphrasing, the definition comes from the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Illnesses. This is DSM-5. It's in the fifth TR. Text revision has come out. But basically, just if I could paraphrase.
Yes, ma'am, paraphrase. That's what we need to do, paraphrase.
Yes, it is just autism spectrum disorder is a spectrum. In other words, a spectrum of multiple layers and multiple, you know, presentations, different, a wide array of things that you would know regarding to communication, deficits in communication, to deficits in socialization, deficits in behavior and emotion regulation, and various degrees of severity. And that's what the key thing is. It's varying degrees of severity. You'll come across people who will display a couple of the symptoms and to some degree, some minute degree, and others who are, you know, off the charts with many of the symptoms. And so basically, that's just what it is, a multitude of varying degrees, you know, of what it's experienced. And you mentioned like folks like Elon Musk and those people are higher on the spectrum. And it is now in three divisions, autism one, autism level, in three levels, level one, level two, and level three. Level three being the most severe. And I personally would like to highlight that, a little bit later on. But the people that you mentioned, they're level one. You can barely tell that they're contending with anything at all.
And they may have more challenges on the more interpersonal connections, the emotional reciprocity in those areas, but they might be highly functioning in other areas of their life. And because of that, it's hard to see it. But on an intimate level, people might be able to feel, touch, and understand where they may struggle at. They may have difficulties identifying and expressing emotion.
Right. Yeah. And relationship issues because of deficits in communication, expressing and receptive and expressive language. So.
And sometimes it's a joy because those type of individuals bring a no nonsense, practical approach and reasoning that seems like it's very logical and it makes sense. Whereas, you know, a lot of us may get caught up in our emotions and our feelings and we look at things and analyze it with all this stuff. They may look at things pretty cut and dry and we look at that and we're like, okay, what? Like they don't see that, they don't feel that, they don't get that. So some of those people on the higher level, it seems like their way of thinking and feeling is very necessary, and we need some of that because sometimes so much of our decision making is so blurred with the emotional stuff.
You know, irrespective of where they are on the spectrum, the higher functioning individuals, like you said, so delightful, and you can't even tell oftentimes, you know, that they are contending with anything. And then there's, you know, people who are level two and level three that are, you know, struggling severely, and they have what's called comorbidities. You know, they could have something else wrong with them as well. Example to my son, who is severe on the spectrum, and you hear more about individuals who are higher end on the spectrum. They're right. Doing all of these marvelous and amazing things, but you don't hear very much about individuals who are on the lower end of the spectrum. And some of the things that their abilities that they have, the varying abilities that they have and the things that they're able to do are marvelous as well.
Right, so, right. So, look, I know that they say like 1 in 35 children are diagnosed with autism. 1 in 45 adults have autism. We know that about 70% of children diagnosed with autism will graduate from high school. That's a good thing. And most of them will have some type of special education services to support them as they move through the process and gaining their education. And many of them through vocational rehab services will be able to get jobs and go on and live some normal level of life. But then we have those that are level twos and level threes, where this is a far more difficult challenge. And you're talking about your son, and you want to tell us a little bit more about him?
Well, our son, well, he's 28 now, but mm-hmm. his journey was difficult because he, being severe, one of the things that you see in the severity is like little to no expressive communication language. Mm-hmm. And so we had to make sure that he had a mechanism for communication. And so we were able to discover that he could, you know, he could actually write. So thank goodness to just persistence in going to various educational realms that he was in, different educational situations that he learned to write, and he could write his name. And what he did learn to do is he could duplicate, he could write what he would see something and he could duplicate it and write it down, you know, mm-hmm. even in his state of where he was. And we discovered this by one day, he likes going to the store mm-hmm. and he would write down CVS. And then when he first started doing that, I was like, what? He's mm-hmm. writing down where he wants to go because he wasn't able to articulate it. And right. I think that a lot of behaviors kind of stem from, you know, wanting to communicate and deficits in communication. So about Michael, just he was diagnosed at age two and a half when a relative noticed something unusual about Michael and suggested that we have someone, you know, look at him. And so I went to various specialists and talk about like the diagnosis, the evolution, for lack of a better word, of mm-hmm. the diagnosis and the description of it. Mm-hmm. This doctor said to me, your son either has mental retardation, PDD, Tourette's. He just began to name off a bunch of disorders. And he said, or all of the above. And so I'm incidentally glad that that designation of mental retardation has been gone by the wayside in the advent of DSM-5, because, you know, like I mentioned before, I mentioned about comorbidities. Individuals who are lower at the lower end of the spectrum tend to also have other issues that they're dealing with. And my son's instance, he has seizure disorder, and thank God he hasn't had any in a while. And he also deals with intellectual developmental disability, which back then that doctor said, oh, he's probably mentally retarded. You know, sometimes people say things. Right. But anyway, that's what he said back then. And that designation is now IDD, intellectual developmental disorder. And so he was branded that. It's kind of pretty obvious he wasn't able to speak. And we were thinking, hoping, you know, when he was younger, that he would eventually talk, and he never did.
Right.
He did start, but however, we continued with speech therapy, physical therapy, occupational therapy. We had him doing those, and we were able to develop things in him. And with those therapies, we were able to help. He was able to develop a means of communication. They have something that's called PEX. You probably heard of it, picture exchange system, mm-hmm. where, you know, the person would, see a picture of something that they wanted, and they'd show you this picture. Mm-hmm. That's a means of communication. So we did a combination of that with him and doing that with him in terms of, like, picture schedules. Okay, so first you're going to do this, then that, then this. And he caught on to it and was able to function through that. He's 28 right now. So he's a young man now. Yes. Anyway, and he does his own thing.
Gotcha.
But he needs, that's something that I didn't say, that the severity levels are also in contingent upon the level of supports that are required of the individual.
Right. You know what? So we're going to move through that. So you was able to get your son help when he was 2.5?
Yes, yes. So like I said, that doctor that we were talking about, and so the best thing, different doctors that I would go to. Mm-hmm. We went to somebody who was considered the guru back then, I don't know now, but back then was considered the guru of autism, this gentleman, this doctor, and people would call him to come and speak in various places, and he was considered the guru. And what he said to me was, there's nothing I can do for you. Your best bet is to go to and join a support group. So instead, we formed one. And continue to talk to other specialists. And that's how we found different information regarding how to help my son. And there are some agencies and things that we were able to shift and help us go into the direction of where to get services for him and things that he needs.
Right. You know, I think that's amazing. I also think that the fact that you was able to get him help at the age of, like, before he was even 3, because on average, even today, people don't get help with autism until they're past 4 years old.
Yeah.
But the fact that you was able to get him help before he was 3 probably helped expedite his development and social-emotional, you know, development. And that was beneficial because, I mean, I want to speak to that a little bit, the importance of being able to identify early and start addressing it before your children get a little older.
Right. Because, well, like I said, 2.5 at that time, you know, that was the recommendation. You know, if you discovered something that your child was not meeting certain milestones by a certain age, go get it checked out, go get it addressed. And at that time, there was things obvious. He was not relating to other people. Mm-hmm. He was not speaking. He was not even, like, the way he would play, he would just kind of stay to him. There were symptoms and signs at an early age that came on that were indicators that we should probably, you know, seek out specialists. Mm. And so I was vigilant about doing that when he was younger and going to various therapies and seeking out various professionals that would address this. And even then, at that time, this was about, you know, when the designation autism in and of itself was first being developed. As I mentioned before, that that doctor when we that we first saw just began to spew out a plethora of alphabet soup, if you will,
right?
Letters, PDD, NOS, you know, things like that. And at that time, I was just beginning. I didn't know. And so seeking out that information, like from the professionals and from other people, you know, knocking on doors until I got the answers that I was looking for.
Gotcha.
At an early age. And that's crucial. Like you said, that is crucial to start early, because that early intervention, I would say that that facilitated his ability to write, his ability to navigate school. Because even at that time, they had what was called early intervention centers.
Right. Because the human brain is so, it is growing fast in our early years. And so the faster we get, we start learning and engaging in processes that help us address challenges we may have, the more likely we can move towards what might be considered more normal behavior. And, you know, I think a lot of parents, when they see things going on with their children early on, they may pass it off as, oh, they're just a little different. Or, you know, you did that?
I did.
Talk about that a little bit.
I did. A relative notice, and I, you might want to get this checked out. Something's not quite right. Or and I was like, he's a boy. Boys develop slowly. I just kept passing it off like that. And this was starting at about 18 months. You know, people noticed, you know, that he wasn't doing things. And, you know, and of course I was carrying him around, you know, but people noticed things. And I was the same thing. He's just developing slowly. And then one of our relatives just suggested that, you know, speech therapist. And the speech therapist from the community where we lived at the time came and said, she just spelled it out for me.
And the speech therapist, obviously she wasn't a medical doctor, but the speech therapist had worked with a lot of kids with vocational challenges with speech and had observed and witnessed a lot of different things with children. So she saw some things that red flags went off to her. And so she came to you guys and said that. And so a lot of times we don't trust like people or think they are just telling us stuff, but really they see stuff because they've had a lot of experience. Teachers oftentimes have had a lot of experience and they see stuff that we may not see. I remember some years ago working with a young man who was highly intelligent and going to a very prestigious school. But when I started working with him, I realized he might be on the spectrum and the experiences. But it was difficult for the family because they were like, he's here, he's doing this. But look at the type of problems, the repetitive issues, the way he gets stuck on particular issues and situations, and the fixated, the depressive symptoms, and the difficulty socializing. You could see it was all there, but he was functioning very high level, but it was difficult for the family. But I've also seen families, you know, who maybe have identified it, but they never move past the initial stages of grief. And so it feels like they're always looking for their child to wake up one day and be more normal.
Yeah, I know. I've been there.
Don't go nowhere. Stay tuned for the next episode of Therapy is Life, where thinking, feeling, and experiencing well-being will be continued with our discussion on autism spectrum disorder.